Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Ireland's asylums loom large in the imaginations of many, but none more so than my next guest, Niall Breslin. We know him as Brezzy. He's the well-known mental health advocate, podcaster and educator, and he has a new podcast series which explores the history of one woman who was a patient in St Lomond Hospital in Mullingar over 125 years ago, and it's a story about her family's decades-long quest to honour her memory. Niall, you are very, very welcome.
Thank you so much. How are you?
Really, really good. Look, before we get into the Madman's Hotel, even the name of the podcast is extraordinary. This is a story about a woman who was incarcerated in St Lomond's Hospital in Mullingar, and she had accused her husband of adultery, and she ended up in this Gothic institution. Before we get into her story, talk to me about the power that St Lomond's as an institution held over you as a child.
You know, I think what they used to call them, the district lunatic asylums, that's what they were built as. I think the towns that have them, everyone has a story from them. And in my case, St Lomond's was the GAA, St Lomond's GAA, the Pitch and Putt was there. My best mate, you know, Deck, who's the Blizzard's drummer, lived across the road. You can't miss these things. There was three buildings in Mullingar. There was the Army Barracks, there was the Cathedral, and there was St Lomond's. And St Lomond's terrified me. And actually, the more you learn about things that terrify you, the less terrifying they are, because you humanise them. And I think that's what this did for me.
But was it the building? Because it was a huge example. I know it closed in 2013, but it was a huge Gothic building. You know, even the image on the front of the podcast, you look at it and you're imagining what went on behind those walls.
It's the vastness of it. It is just so vast. And people used to always say, you know, we kind of joke about it, that people didn't know this stuff was going on. These places weren't subtle. Like, some of them were over massive, like GAA pitches and stuff. You knew they were there. And I think that was the point. I think they were used as a domineering kind of fear factor to each town. They made people realize, if you don't conform or if you don't fit into what we expect of you, this is the type of place you could end up in.
But you know what you just said there, like, I mean, there were over 20 of these located all around Ireland, and they were big employers in towns. Mm. You know, they were big buildings. They had lots of different functions, and as you say, it was in plain sight, and yet they had this hold over us.
And there was secondary employment. There's even things like, I was thinking, like burgers. Like, there was burgers going in from the butcher. Like, there was, like, these, like, Lomond's was built for 300 people, but there was thousands in it by the end. And that was the big problem with the asylums, is they weren't built for that amount of people. So the medical men, as they were referred to, very quickly moved away from treatment to just, how do we control them? How do we, you know, there's too many people here. But the employment thing was really important, because at one stage in Mullingar, like, which was a kind of a market regional town, there was nearly 30% people working there. And this is a huge number. And that changed over the years. But I was very aware of that, because I also still have friends who work there and their family members work there. And I wanted to provide a story that kind of highlighted some of the incredible people that work there as well, while also talking about the really dark stuff that happened.
And it is that, it's that sort of the dark stuff. Like, a lot of those institutions are closed now, or, you know, they're derelict, but they still sort of wield a huge power. And I suppose they remind us perhaps of our own vulnerabilities in respect of our mental health, because none of us, not least of all you, know that you cannot take that for granted.
No. And I think this is the point. The most difficult thing I learned in this work and in my research, and I've been studying this, like, forensically for 3 years, is that an awful lot of people who ended up in these places had nothing wrong with them. Now, there were people who were very unwell and needed help, but the vast majority of people that you start to pull the tread on, you start to go, no, there's nothing, there's no real evidence of anything serious here. And then you start to pull the tread further and go underneath that. And it becomes really upsetting, because you start, you know, one of the lines in the actual series was from Julia's records. And the line, that's the thing that started it for me. She said, I'm not insane, and neither are half the people in here. And that wasn't a lie.
Well, let's maybe just go back and introduce our listeners to Julia. Julia Leonard was a married mother who over 100 years ago was committed to St Lomond's on the word of her husband. How did this hand of history and of this vulnerable woman reach out and find you?
You know what? When I first found this story, I ran a mile from it, because I wasn't in a particularly great place myself. It was, I think it was in and around when The Voice was being recorded. I got a petition, an Uplift petition sent about the graveyard in St. Omans, saying it's now just a mass grave. There's 1,304 people buried here. And I was like, no, thank you. I'm not.
And I know you've spoken about this before, you had been suffering from some fairly severe panic attacks that had plagued you since your teenage years. So this probably, was it the right time for someone to
No,
be?
This wasn't the right time. And I kind of put it aside. And also Lomans held something in me that I didn't want to even look at or think about. And
was that the fear that you could end up, if not in that place, in somewhere like it?
Yeah. And that's just like when I was 15, I remember I'd just come back from Israel. I lived in Israel. My dad was in UNIFIL. He was one of those incredible UNIFIL peacekeepers that we're seeing in the news now. My dad was there many, many times, I think three or four tours of duty there. And we went with him in 93, and it was what is now referred to, I think, as the 9-Day War or Operation Accountability. And I just remember that was the moment, feeling that something had shifted in me. And when I came home, I never fully processed or understood it. And Kurt Cobain then died, which also had a real impact on me. But at that point, I didn't know what was wrong. So I thought it was asthma all my life. I thought I was struggling with asthma because I was catching my breath every night. And I was terrified to tell people. I remember going into hospital for another injury, and I was going to tell the doctor what was wrong with me. And all that went through my head in that last moment is that they'll go and put me in St. Lomans if I tell them what I think's wrong. So I never said it. And it was just that overbearing fear that that place had over everybody. And that you know, in the 90s, people go, wasn't that long ago, but we are a hell of a lot further on now about talking about these conversations than we were in the 90s. But this was the point. This is the thing that kind of...
But your life changes in moments, and, you know, you get an email, you decide, I'm not going there.
Nope.
So how did this late great woman find you?
I came back to it. It just kept coming back. I kept seeing it coming up. And then I couldn't run away from it. I can't describe it really. And now when I spoke to Julie and her family, who Julia's great-great-granddaughter, she talked of this dream she kept having of Julie standing over her bed telling her, please tell this story, please tell this story. And that was the thing that got me, was the dream, because Kathy, who's another family member, said she had the same dream. And I didn't have the dream, but I just had this feeling that we have to do something here. And
so these phenomenal women, and I know that Julianne Clark was, if I'm correct, she was the great granddaughter of Julia Leonard, who'd been, like many people, put in on the word of her husband, never to be released, who died quite young. I think she was only in her 50s.
She died of a broken heart in 1919. And like when you look... So the real context is important. She was committed under what is called the Dangerous Lunatics Act, which was just an absolutely awful, reactive piece of legislation that was designed, I think, after some bank clerk was stabbed in Dublin. And it didn't require a hell of a lot of evidence to put people in. And it was badly abused for many reasons, not to judgment. A lot of people were there was huge poverty. There was the famine, all of these things. People used it as a way of offsetting their loved ones. It's like, it's very easy to judge history. And, you know, living in this hugely wealthy country we live in now, like, it's very easy to take a lens on something. And like, I'm not a historian, but historians tell you that if you want to properly study something, you have to bring that contextual lens to it. You have to understand all the different elements of what was going on at the time. And a lot of families were putting people into institutions because they couldn't afford to feed them, they couldn't rest them, and some of them may have had other issues or were disruptive, alcoholism, and they couldn't do anything about it.
But the men tended, if I'm correct from your research, the men tended to go in for, they might have been violent, might have been alcoholic, but the women went in for, sort of doing air quotes here, for things that are very, very familiar still to women now, you know, hysteria or, you know, emotional problems. And this woman had accused her husband of adultery. I think she was...
This is the thing. This will tell you how legal acts work and why it was such a difficult one to get around. She was put in for accusing her husband of cheating on her and true tea at him. And he said, she's delusional, she's crazy, get her in there. And the guys came and took her away. A couple of days later, he went off with the woman that she had accused and put the children into a workhouse.
And went on to have other women with
the other. And even with that information, so now we now know she wasn't delusional, that this actually happened. They still couldn't take her out because he had to be the person that took her out and he had committed her.
So how did Julianne Clark, who was obviously named, I think, for her great-grandmother, How did she make that connection if her grandfather, if I'm following this right,
Christopher,
ended up in the workhouse?
So this was Sheila, who was one of the other unbelievable researchers in this, you know, Kathy's mum, started to pull the thread on. She realised that Julia had a child when she went into St. Omans about 9 months later. So that will tell you. And Christopher was born and he stayed there for a few months, and then they took Christopher out and put him into a workhouse. And then he was then fostered and to a beautiful family in Carlstown in Kinnegad, and he was really well looked after.
Which
and
was not the fate of many.
No, it really wasn't. And she said that, but I don't want to give away too much of what happens, but there's a moment in...
There's a lot of plot twists in it, to be fair.
Well, like, one that broke me was involved Christopher. And, you know, in my head, and I haven't said this to many people, one of the dreams I had of doing this was that we exhumed Julia's body and we buried her with her children. That's what we wanted. And we very quickly realised that wouldn't happen because the graveyard was... The crosses were picked up. We didn't know where they were for whatever reason.
So just to get this right in my own mind, there were hundreds of crosses.
Yes.
Until quite recently in contemporary history.
Yeah.
And then one day they're gone and they're in storage. But they would have been the markers for Niall Breslin is here, Dermot MacDonald is there, Julia Caffrey-Leonard is there. And did you lose that opportunity?
Yeah. And not only lost it, John Tierney, the archaeologist, did an amazing job of kind of plotting the graveyard, but that's all it was. You can't really find where people are. But the point being
but
is...
people in Mullingar presumably have a living memory of the graveyard with the crosses.
Yeah, but they weren't mapped. For whatever reason, I think we accept that there might have been vandalism, but they picked them all up. And the thing that broke my heart with it was, and these are the things you learn about Irish history, is they were buried with numbers, like they were prisoners, like they had broken the law. Pretty much all these people had never broken the law. And they were buried with numbers because of the shame. The family didn't want their family name on the crosses. They were buried with numbers because they were treated like prisoners. In a country that just gained its independence, we you know, and this is a story, in Ireland, we like to bring a lens on who to kind of point the finger at. Church had very little to do with how the institutions were run. The church weaponized shame in Ireland and we used it on each other. And this was definitely a contributor.
But isn't that the key, that we used it on each other? Because even, you know, you've been involved with this extraordinary campaign to restore those crosses, literally or figuratively, in that graveyard. But you can't even guarantee that now that those families will want to go back and perhaps open up what may be a shameful chapter in their own intergenerational lives.
So true. And there was a point in it, I think, in the series. I think the one that got me was, once again, without giving away too much, of one of the guys putting the cross of his loved one into the cemetery and with their name on it. And he held it and he was kind of crying. And I said to him, you know, can I ask you a question? He said, yeah. I said, why is this still so raw for you? You know, this loved one was buried 100 years ago. He said, that loved one affected my grandmother, affected my mother, affected me. And it was passed on.
The intergenerational trauma.
And we had this shame and we had this constant fear that someone would find out. And now I'm getting to honour her.
Were those crosses now, like if a family knew the number, could they go and retrieve that little white cross?
Many of the crosses are now, they're cast iron crosses and they're stored in a shed by the HSE. And may I add, the HSE have been quite supportive of this.
Spoke to the CEO,
yeah,
Bernard Gloucester.
This didn't happen under their watch, really. They're now the gatekeepers of what we call the asylums. Would this be high on their priority list? Probably not, but we need to make it important because this is symbolic. People say to me, like, why is this important? It's because there's still legacies that prevail from these systems in our current system. There's still legacies that prevail in the stigma that we have around mental health that comes from this conditioning and this time. And I think Ireland can be the symbol globally because no one's ever done this. No one's ever actually looked back at the history of what happened in institutions around the world. And some of the most brutal treatments and the brutal treatments of humanity happen in those places. Some of the most beautiful things happen too, but really they weren't good places.
Because one of the people you interview is Brendan Kelly, who really has a very incredible understanding of our history and the social and economic context in which they evolved. And we sort of pride ourselves now, well, look, it's all about care in the community and not institutionalising people. But I think what the podcast will do will maybe tap into, as you say, those kind of latent fears and that latent sort of stigma. You know, what's interesting, you are so moved, you know, when you can hear it in your voice in the podcast, when you're perhaps angry or upset and you can feel that emotion. And I'm just wondering, what is this, What is this doing to you in terms of someone who has struggled with their mental health and arguably has made tackling all of the stigma your own life's purpose?
Well, it's not easy work. When you're reading these stories and you're researching what happened, the thing about it is we know this happened. So we know it happened. So that this, to me, is the last shadow of Irish history that we haven't really taken on and looked at. And I think the reason we find this one particularly difficult is because it requires society to put a mirror up to itself. That's what it does. You know, we can't, we put more people into institutions after the British left. The church had, once again, had very little to do with it. So we have to look at ourselves. And I think what happened is, you know, when Ireland gained independence and De Valera decided to say to the church, you decide what's moral and ethical and what, how we conform to society, anyone who fell out of that really narrow view of how we should be as human beings ended up in institutions in Ireland.
Poor people.
You know, Magdalen laundries, mother and baby homes, asylums. We have to talk about this. And I know it's difficult to talk about. I know it's upsetting. And this is not about blaming anybody. You cannot do that here. I think we've had enough blame with this. I think what we got to do, and I think when I look at the Madman's Hotel, somebody said to me about, oh, it's a bit, you know, it's a bit of an offensive title. I said, the context is, was written, that poem was written by a patient. And as I said to that person, let's not get offended by historical contextual language. Let's get offended by the fact that the CAMHS report last year said there's 2.5 year waiting lists for children for mental health care. There's a lack of clinical governance in the CAMHS system, that the Mental Health Commission have said we have to have a root and branch change of our entire system. That's the stuff we've got to bring our hearts to.
So is that why you say, or if I haven't got it wrong, I think there was a point where you were saying that you believe that St. Lomans is something we can learn from, you know, from that history. Like, I mean, what was really heartbreaking is that, you know, even though she died early, I think she was there for over 20 years, but Julia Leonard is protesting why she is there at all. And I think that's a sort of a universal cry that many people will identify then and now.
The most heartbreaking part of it is, number one, no one visited Julia. Nobody. Not one person.
And how do you think her family, her contemporary family, her descendants feel about that?
The bravery of them to talk about this. They said this just didn't happen. But, you know, maybe they did, but we can't get access to her full medical records. That's another conversation. And I think Bernard Glosser was very honest about that. Like, they know we were able to get probably better access to records on TikTok by people breaking into these hospitals rather than actually through the formal ways. So we got to find a way of archiving these. And I know the HSE are looking at this now very proactively.
And it's, you know, that is not an easy or a sensitive issue. You know, you're trying to protect the dignity of the person when they're alive, but also while they're dead. Do you think it's one of the reasons perhaps why it wasn't just, you know, throw up a memorial wall with every single name? Do you need the consent of the other families in order to,
you see, this is
to depict their story and the legacy of those times?
I think this is the moral dilemma that we kind of navigated throughout the whole thing. And Julie and her family absolutely believe that we should be putting, with the access of the 1,304 people buried there, and their names should be going up. What I would love, personally, what I would love is that if these families came forward and actually said, I think I have a loved one here who's
can
buried.
Can you understand why they might not?
Oh yeah, of course I can. Absolutely I can. And the most important point I made about this is, I think once these families are aware that their loved ones didn't fail society, society failed them. We didn't do what was right. And that's not because we were all terrible bad people. It's because we had serious sociological kind of constraints in this country. We had serious issues. We had famine, we had trauma, we had civil wars, war for independence. It was consistent.
It was consistent, but even it was quite contemporary. Like, one of the staff members that you spoke to spoke of he just said, we were their family. When they didn't have family, we were their family. And he was saying that, you know, that they cared about the patients, and often when they died, there was no one else.
There wasn't.
There for them. And that wasn't in 1919 or 1925. That is actually much, much more recent.
The 80s. And
in our history.
I remember growing up in the 80s that they used to walk the patients around the hospital, and we would shout abuse at the patients. We were children, like, we didn't know. And the nurses used to...
What kind of abuse would you shout at them?
You know, just like, I didn't even know what it was. We were mocking them because we didn't know.
And
then
kids.
The nurses were like, they were so protective of those patients. They were so kind to them. I just remember the way they used to walk them, they put their arm around them and they'd walk them, and And it's that stuff I really wanted to get across. Yes, the treatments, we now know, like Brendan Kelly will tell you this. Brendan's one of my mentors. Brendan's actually one of the core reasons I decided to do a PhD, because of his work. And when he'll talk about it, he'll say it was therapeutic enthusiasm or therapeutic desperation. A lot of these people were desperate to help, but some of the treatments were absolutely barbaric. And these cannot be forgotten. Malaria treatment, insulin coma therapy, lobotomy. And then psychopharmacology came in the 50s, and we didn't even know what it was. Some of those treatments were just so, they called them chemical lobotomies. So I still think we have a long way to go.
Like they are barbaric when we look back, but again, judging them by contemporary standards, again, can sort of blind us to perhaps what people were trying to deal with at the time. There was a time when, you know, all of those treatments were probably welcomed potentially.
Do you know how it started, though? This is the interesting thing I always thought of mental health. Before the asylums were really being built, and even Grange Gorman, which to me is the beacon of what we should do with these institutions. Some of the most impressive things I've ever seen in my life is what they've done to Grange Gorman, and we should celebrate that. It is phenomenal what was done up there. It is a place of education. It's as nice a campus as I've ever seen. And that was one of the biggest asylums in the country. But when that was first open, we had a thing called moral management. And moral management was kind of an idea of Robert Tuke, the Quakers. And their idea of somebody in mental health distress was to bring them away to a farm, to feed them, to rest them, to talk with them, to walk with them, to get them into nature. That was the way we treated. And Grange Gorman started as that. Let's do the right thing. Let's give them refuge, because that's what they were called. But then very quickly, the prisons were overcrowded, put them in there. Anybody who did not conform or anybody.
And there's a big question around the mental health supports for people who are currently in prison and the synergies between
that. But these are the legacies. The people say, why do we do this work? Because the legacies still prevail. The thing about it is, and I'll say this around this work, I think society is very comfortable now talking about stress and anxiety and other kind of overwhelms that we have mentally. But I think when we get into the weeds with the more difficult stuff, the stuff that we have to address here, I still think we've a long way to go. I still think we have a fear.
So what is Julia Cafford-Leonard's legacy? Like, you know, her finding you sort of across history and time, what do you hope that the podcast will achieve? Because it's not just a story about this family, of course it is, and other families, but what do you hope the upshot of this will be?
I think what I would love to see is, yes, I would love to see a memorial wall. I'd love to see families come forward with their consent to put their names with their crosses, not numbers, back in the ground where I think we should honour and create the cemetery in St. Olmans as a symbol and a recognition of what happened in our past, so we can actually decide how we want to move forward here. We cannot pretend this didn't happen. We can't wish this stuff away. And I think Lomans can be a real symbol for this. And I think all the other institutions have stories too. And I think even internationally we can be a symbol, because no country has really decided to take this on and say, listen, what happened was at times really difficult, but we have to. I think Ireland can be world leaders at youth mental health. I think we can be symbolic and stand up. I think there should be some form of state apology for what happened in these institutions. Obviously not high on the list of agendas for in an election cycle. But I genuinely think if we're serious about this, then we have to do something here. And I don't think families want to blame anybody. I think they just want some integrity back. And the ultimate goal of this whole series was to give people some dignity back in death that was taken from them in life. There's 1,304 people buried in St. Lomans. Why not turn it into a cemetery again? Why not turn it into a beautiful place where families can go and not be embarrassed of their past or shamed of their past? And that to me, and why not turn Lomans into what Grange Gorman is now? These beautiful buildings, well, let's turn them into something. Maybe turn them into places of education where we can train people to better support people who find themselves in mental health distress. More nurses, psychologists. We're crying out for them. So I think it takes a bit of bravery and courage from our political leaders, because I don't think they know what to do here. And that's what Bernard Gloucester said at the end. And I have so much respect for that. Because we can often go, give us an answer. He goes, I don't know. And you know what? If someone's saying that, we should give them space and say, fair enough. Let's actually decide together what we want to do with this past. And, you know, I think hopefully the HSE will come on board. They've been, as I said, as proactive as they could have been, they have been. And if you turn up for something with conflict, that's what you'll get in return. This happened all over the world. That's important. But above everything, anyone listening to this who thinks they might have somebody buried in St. Lomans that they would like to come forward and... We have an amazing team, friends@julia.com. Just reach out to us. We'll go there with you. We'll put it into the ground.
I'm sure that anyone, Niall Breslin, who is listening probably has one of those asylums that loomed large in their imaginations, absolutely, in their mind. But best of luck with The Madman's Hotel on Audible. And thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much.